from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to the Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll grab a fork and get a preview of the Dig In food event.
Yum. I'm going to find out what's going on at iMocha this summer.
And Melissa Davis will join us for a special Indie Fringe Fest interview, and we'll have our Arts Calendar Week haul.
What'll we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The farm-to-fork movement is getting stronger and stronger in our state, making it a great time to be a Hoosier foodie. Nowhere is that more apparent than at Dig In, coming up Sunday, August 25th at the White River State Park, with general admission from noon to 5. Sharon Gamble invited Executive Director Rob Gaston and Board Member Andy Dietrich to our studios to learn what's new this year and how Dig In connects food producers year-round.
So, Rob, what attracted you to this relatively new job as Dig In Executive Director?
I think it's just a great organization that has the ability to promote foods and culinary arts that come from Indiana. And there's so much agriculture here in the state, and what most people know about is that we produce a lot of corn and a lot of soybeans, and that's an important agricultural product for us.
Sure.
But there's also great other things to eat here in Indiana, like hydroponic greens. There are people that are producing, you know, pork all over the state that you can go buy a whole pig from. I mean, there's lots of opportunity to buy product to purchase and eat in Indiana that people just don't know about.
Sure. And Andy, I know as a longtime employee of Farm Bureau and as a Dig In board member, you're well aware of the multiplicity of foods available.
When you talk about local farmers, that means a little different thing to everybody. But for us at Indiana Farm Bureau and through Indiana's family of farmers, the local is anybody in the state of Indiana. And as Rob said, we see the corn, we see the soybeans. But as you're driving around the state, you really should, you owe it to yourself to stop at local stands and to stop at farmers markets. Or if there's a meat processing plant in a small town, that's where you're going to get something that was on the hoof that morning. And
wow,
it's local, it's locally raised, and you can pretty much tell where it came from. So plenty of opportunities, not just at Dig In, but throughout the state of Indiana.
So talk about, so Dig In, everybody knows the big festival that's certainly coming up soon, but what's happening with Dig In the rest of the year beyond planning for the festival? I assume you're making a lot of connections between and among farmers and chefs, and what else is going on?
I think we'd like to approach all of our constituents. So we're in talks about getting together with our producers and partnering them with our chefs, which is certainly what we do at the event.
Right.
But also doing that in another setting where we can bring them together to talk about how we can connect them more often throughout the year and get the Indiana producers into the restaurants and maybe into more institutions as well. And I think we'd also like to address our restaurants and our customers and connect them more often.
Because as good as that all sounds, is making those connections and getting local food into institutions and restaurants.
What do you mean by institutions?
Hospitals,
ah,
schools.
Okay, sure.
Hotels, even, bigger scale.
Big companies that have their own cafeterias.
Exactly.
Yeah.
At our building, the Farm Bureau building, Aramark is our food provider.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do a whole lot with local foods.
Sure.
And there are reasons for that. There are health department reasons. There are regulatory reasons. Some of those are just, things that small growers need to learn. How do I create a market? How do I make a contract with this company? Do I need to go through a wholesaler, or can I work directly with a restaurant?
Can I produce enough to fulfill this contract?
Exactly. And I think when you have a chef who is saying, I need these ingredients at this time, that's a little different than just saying, okay, I'll take what you have right now. And it puts a little more emphasis on the farming aspect of a small producer and being more businesslike in how they approach it.
Huh. So the restaurants who participate are, do you choose restaurants for Dig In, A Taste of Indiana? Do you choose your restaurants based on who's already locally sourcing, or do you have some restaurants in mind and say, hey, would you consider using ingredients created here in the state, or some of each?
It's a mix. It's a mix of exactly what you said. So, of course, we were just talking about Goose the Market a little bit ago, and probably one of the top producers who sources local product.
Sure.
So, of course, they're one of our headliners for the event. At the same time, if we get approached by... So the first thing that happens when someone approaches us about participating is a discussion about what use of local product do you participate in right now? And if they're wanting to, or if they've just started, then they make a great partner for the event because they can go through the event and learn what's available seasonally in Indiana, and they can actually learn how they can do it a little bit better and throughout more of the year.
Sure.
I think what Rob brings is your experience as a procurement officer probably knows more about the ups and downs and pitfalls of local sourcing than anybody does, because if you're trying to get big volumes of food, it can be tough to be completely locally sourced. And I know Ivy Tech used a lot of food.
Yeah, and we should describe what job he's referencing there. In a past life, you...
Sure, so... For about 2.5 years, I was the purchasing coordinator for the Ivy Tech Hospitality Department. And what that means is that I was responsible for anything that came through the door for the culinary and baking programs. So any meat, any baking goods, even paper goods and cleaning supplies, all that stuff. But absolutely, to Andy's point, as a society, we've kind of gotten away from seasonality. And we've forgotten
Absolutely.
That certain things are only available at certain times.
Sure. So what do you mean I can't get watermelon in December, huh?
Right.
Well, you can, but it's not going to be coming from Southern
right,
Indiana.
Right.
Yeah.
So even chefs still sometimes fall into that trap. And that's one of the things that we do as we source for the festival, is that chefs communicate their desires for product. And many times we have to come back and say, that's probably not going to be available from the state of Indiana. Maybe not right now, or maybe in another season, but, you know, it's just not something
too
we're going to be able to work
late.
With.
So have you thought about this or this or this? And I think we go into it with a pretty good list of what is available, both on the protein and, you know, the fruit and vegetable side. So they have some targets to look at.
Sure. So somebody might want, say, might want to do a dish with cherries, which... We don't have a huge cherry crop in Indiana. We have a little cherry crop in Indiana, right?
Little,
it tends
yeah.
to be a cooler climate.
Exactly.
But it also would be earlier in the year than Taste of Indiana. So you might come back and say, but have you considered raspberries?
Correct.
Which are in season. Okay,
right.
Cool.
So great lead-in, Sharon, because Cerulean, right downtown here at Cityway, did ask for cherries this year.
Oh, really?
And at the point we were having that conversation, I said... I know cherries are in right now, and actually put in a call to Piazza right away, who's a partner on the event, and we made some quick phone calls and found out there were some cherries at Garwood Orchards in northern Indiana, and we had to make like a day of decision to get those cherries ordered and picked up, because otherwise they were going to crack and split overnight and probably be falling off the
trees.
So
did you freeze them?
We did. They did. We actually
We
picked. So Piazza picked up the cherries, brought them here, and then delivered them to Cerulean, where they processed and froze them.
You spend a lot of time with spreadsheets, don't you? Just dragging
all
this.
Oh, it's all up here.
Oh, that's scary. So are some of these chefs creating, I'm guessing they're creating dishes just for this event?
For the most part, I would say yes. This is a great opportunity for them to showcase their talent and really, you know, put the best dish forward, so to speak.
Because sometimes less is more. In 2 ounces, you have to make your statement. You don't
have
the full plate. So what can you do that is something you can hand off to somebody very easily and is still going to, you know, hit their mouth and make them go, ooh, ah.
And that you can mass produce and that will hold whether it's a cool day or a hot, humid day. So there's a lot of science in there, too.
A cool day this year, not the 105 degrees or whatever that we have seen in the past.
So they're creating dishes that finish cooking as people are carrying them around. So I have to say, as much as I love to eat, it's a challenging event because you have to figure out how to do it and pace yourself. So you've actually you have some more ticket price points and a little bit different schedule this year. Let's talk about that.
Well, the early entry ticket is something that we tried out last year, and for the people that took advantage of it, they just loved it. So for the early entry,
I'll vouch for that. I did.
Great. The early entry ticket allows you 1 hour in the park with basically hundreds of people as opposed to thousands of people. So the lines are much shorter. It's a lot easier to get around to all those top chefs that you want to make sure you sample. And it's a great bargain.
And then you're also limiting the number of tickets, right?
Yeah, it's a real balancing act to find out how many people can fit the space comfortably.
Sure.
We are not Disney, and we don't know about people moving the way the Disney folks do, but we're learning every year. And
sure.
I think that's what the early entry, the VIP ticket, which is another, I don't know, a couple hundred, I think. How many VIPs are there?
150.
Very special things going on there with a separate space, a lot more access to the chefs and people bringing food to you, so you don't necessarily have to run around unless you want to. And then, you know, general admission for the rest of the show, again, limited to 4,000 tickets this year, so we may not see the crowds we had.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, what are a couple of the most unusual dishes you're anticipating for this year's event? Maybe unusual because of ingredients or combination of ingredients.
There's a lot of duck this year. I was going down the list, and there seemed to be a number of different ways to do duck. And
we're a big duck producing.
We are a very big duck producing state. Both Culver and Maple Leaf up north produce a lot of ducks, and I believe we are the number one duck feet exporter to China.
Really?
Yeah. So they use a little bit of all of the duck. See some lamb there, which is always fun. I know some lamb producers, and it's good to get them involved. So it's more than just your meat and potatoes kind of thing.
Sure.
I would also add something that people might not expect to see, and we have had in the past, but Bell Aquaculture perch. Mm. So you can get farm-raised seafood that comes from Indiana. So in addition to the perch, we also have Indiana shrimp this year that will be used by the Ocean Air.
I've read about this. That's so fascinating.
And this is one of those things when we talked a little bit about, you know, the regulatory side. There aren't a lot of Department of Health rules for crustaceans in the state of Indiana.
Understandably. Legislation lags behind for good reason.
Exactly. So as some of these new producers are producing things, can we take it across the county line? Do we have to freeze it? Can it be done fresh? And so some of those things are being worked out as different species are being grown here in Indiana that haven't been in the past.
Hmm. And, you know, all this food's going to make us thirsty. There will be some adult beverages available, as there have been in the past, I believe.
Yes, the breweries are stacking up to participate. So we have a maximum capacity of 18 breweries, and our friend and board member, Clay Robinson from Sun King, has reported that he's very close to filling up those slots. So we'll also have maybe a dozen or so wineries on site.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing to call out is that a couple of our vendors are offering in the department of unique tastes,
mm-hmm.
Something called a shrub.
What's that?
So a shrub is something that it's a beverage that is infused, almost fermented, but not fermented in the sense that you think of wine or beer.
Sure.
So it's fermented with some sugar, and then some type of an acid is added to it. So often it could be like a vinegar, a light vinegar. Black Market is doing an Indiana berry shrub. So this is going to be infused with, I think, strawberries and maybe black raspberries, and it will be fermented for maybe just a week or two. And so that flavor infuses in the liquid, and then it's also carbonated.
Oh, my goodness. That sounds so refreshing and
it does.
Fun.
That's going to be my first stop, I think.
And the other shrub we have is Bee Coffee Roasters is making something called Plum Buzz Iced Coffee. So it would be a plum-infused coffee base that is also carbonated.
It's a good time to live in Indiana.
Oh, it is. It is. And we've done some work with Indiana Humanities over the last couple of years on their Food for Thought initiative, which was two very wonderful years of finding out exactly how rich Indiana's food culture and food heritage really is. And it was an eye-opener for me and really enjoyed that project. But it introduced me personally to a lot of people who may be Farm Bureau members who I haven't met, and you just don't know what they're doing, what they're growing, and what's going on out there. It's a wide-open landscape for food in Indiana right now.
Sharon Gamble with Dig-In's Executive Director Rob Gaston and Board Member Andy Dietrich. Dine your way through Indiana's best locally sourced food and drink on Sunday, August 25th. For info and tickets, including general admission, early admission, VIP experiences, and tickets for children, visit digindiana.org. That's digindiana.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. This month, the Indianapolis Museum of Contemporary Art, or IMOCA, features two exhibits featuring international artists and curated by Indianapolis resident Carla Romero. She's editor of the only bilingual Spanish and English arts magazine, Humanize. Travis DiNicola spoke with Carla and IMOCA's director, Chauté Marsh, about the show and also a new grant from the Andy Warhol Foundation.
First off, I just got to say congratulations on the Andy Warhol Foundation grant. That's huge.
Yes.
That's a big deal. Actually, why don't we start with that?
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about that grant and what that means to IMOCA.
Well, we had been trying for years mm-hmm. to get the Warhol grant, even before I started at IMOCA. I know they had done a site visit before with Christopher West when he was curator at IMOCA.
Sure. Yeah, I remember hearing all about that.
Yeah. So, you know, IMOCA had been a finalist before, and but this time I think they were really interested in what we provide Indianapolis the shows we are. I'm sorry, I'm getting.
No, no, it's
stumbling.
I mean,
we don't censor our exhibits.
Right, and that's a big part of it. Sort of
right.
This like celebration of the First Amendment. Right.
Right.
Because you guys are doing some provocative exhibits.
Yeah.
That's what they want to recognize. Now, is the foundation tied to the Andy Warhol Museum, or
no,
is that okay?
They are separate.
Okay.
You know, and you know, it's a huge honor because it's only one. We were one of 40 organizations, at least nationwide, to receive the funding, and then this is multi-year funding for us as well, and it is restricted to our exhibits, so
mm-hmm.
you know, it doesn't go to salary or rent or anything like that.
That sort
so
of overhead,
it has,
sure.
It's, you know, they're very interested in supporting curators and artists, and so are we, and we had that.
And in fact, the exhibits that are up now were supported
yes.
through the Andy Warhol Foundation.
Yes, that was made possible in large part to the Warhol Foundation grant. You know, most of our exhibits are commissioned,
mm-hmm.
so we'll get in touch with the curator or work one-on-one with an artist to have them make exhibits especially for the Indianapolis audience.
So, Carla, I first met you about a year ago when I was first learning about Humanize Magazine, which is a Spanish-English arts magazine. How's that going, first of all? How is Humanize?
It's going great. We're actually entering into our 22nd issue.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, it's going really well. We've been interviewing a lot of great artists, musicians, writers of from all over the world. So we're very, very lucky to live in this day and age where we can contact anyone at any given time, all over the world, Spanish, English. It's great.
And where is the magazine distributed? I mean, you do stuff online, but you also have a physical magazine.
We have a print on demand option.
Okay.
We don't.
Mm-hmm.
Distribute.
Okay.
So it's online primarily.
Okay. But still, so people could print it out, but going to the website,
humanizemag.com.
Perfect. Is the best way to check it out.
That's
okay.
Right.
So how did you get involved in being part of IMOCA and being asked to curate the shows that are up right now?
Well, actually, I was introduced to Chate March about a year, more than a year ago. Probably May, I believe, May 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And, she told me, I love the magazine. I would love for you to be a guest curator for August 2013. So I was, of course, just honored, and that's
now,
what happened.
Now, when Chate asked you that, had you ever curated before anything? Working in a magazine, certainly you're working in the arts, but, it's a little bit different.
It's a lot different, yeah. I hadn't curated for a gallery or museum. There's this new thing. A lot of people are calling themselves curators when they have online magazines. I hadn't called myself that.
Mm-hmm.
But I had dealt with so many artists, and going through the process of choosing pieces and just the communication between us, I felt pretty confident to do it.
Well, and it sounds like you had some great work to work with and some great artists. The two shows, In the Name of Love and then Ted Unk, is that the way it's pronounced?
Unk.
Unk, mm-hmm. Okay. So let's start with the In the Name of Love piece, all photographs. Tell me about, and both of you, feel free to jump in, tell me about the artist and the show.
Well, Slava Mogutin and Brian Kenny, they are partners, and the first part of the show, there's 24 photographs, and they're shot in a way that Brian, and it's pretty apparent that Brian is Slava's muse, and so you get this glimpse into their relationship, and it really reminds me of vintage photographs, the way they're just gorgeous. And I remember when I opened them, I hadn't seen anything like it, and especially with the subject matter too. It was
no,
just
and I haven't
very
seen
tender.
The show yet, and I'm looking forward to it. And I know it's open through September 21st. Large scale, small scale.
They're 24 by 24.
Okay, but they sound like they're very intimate. Following these two men in their lives and their love for each other. Slava
and then we have
is...
a 3D option too. So.
Oh, do they? That
yeah,
makes it even more fun.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's interesting to look at them with the 3D glasses and without.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. And Slava he's New York based, but he's a Russian artist.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. He was facing 7 years of prison in Russia tried to marry his longtime boyfriend, and also he had his writing. He was accused of spreading gay queer propaganda, I think is what they called it. And so when he had filed for a marriage license, he was, I think, the first person.
Yeah, the first person in Russia.
Yeah,
oh, wow.
To have
okay.
ever applied to marry his partner. And then he received political asylum in the United States. Soon after that.
Great. But excellent.
You want to speak more to him?
Yeah. He's definitely now kind of the symbol for, gay rights without even meaning to. I don't think we talked about this, and he doesn't consider himself a gay artist or a gay photographer.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, undoubtedly become very iconic because, number one, where he's from and all of the, current news about what's happening in Russia,
sure.
all of the homophobic, actions taken by the government and the,
tolerance by the government of all of these homophobic crimes.
Do you know how his work is received in Russia?
It's not, actually. He's very censored in Russia,
yeah.
Especially his writing. Before he came, I tried to do as much research as possible, and he was actually a journalist and a poet in Russia, and I couldn't find anything. And then speaking to him, he said most of it has been censored and is nowhere to be found. So
again, I mean, this is really important from the standpoint of celebrating the First Amendment and mm-hmm. free speech, free expression, which the Andy Warhol Foundation was trying to support.
Right.
So this ties in very well.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, you know, we did receive Russian coverage for this exhibit.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. There was a disclaimer. It was like, you cannot read this article unless you are 18 years or older. And it was essentially the press release.
That wow.
And just a little background information about Slava. So, you know, and I also thought, you know, with the hate legislation we've passed here recently, you know, I felt like this show was important and mm-hmm. was really grateful to Carla for putting it together. And
how have people received the show here so far? You need the opening a couple weeks ago. And
well, I think In the Name of Love, it's mm-hmm. been very positive, actually. A lot of
yeah.
good, positive intellectual discussions and a lot of it just fun, you know.
Good.
A lot of people seeing it and just liking it without going any further than that. So.
Yeah, yeah. It was, you know, we had around 2,000 people through on the first Friday, and that part of the show, we didn't receive much of, if any, of a backlash on it. And, you know, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, I do recognize we are operating almost within a bubble, like where we might be, you know, we may not be reaching
sure.
that broader audience that feels non-accepting of mm-hmm. that of their relationship.
Now, IMOCA is located down Fountain Square.
We yes.
mentioned that, of course, on Virginia Avenue. Mm-hmm. And so the other exhibit that's running concurrent, help me pronounce again, Ted
Onk.
Onk. Ted mm-hmm. Onk. And so Ted Onk is a Dutch female artist.
That's right.
And it's a video piece about her sister. Is that correct?
It's actually three video pieces.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more about that.
Well, Ted Onk is, like you said, she's a Dutch artist, born in Thailand, actually. Lived the first 9 years of her life in Thailand and Oman, and currently resides in Belgium. She has made quite a name for herself in photography, especially more independent photography, the world of independent photography in Europe.
Yeah.
And she uses her everyday experiences with her sister, Pim, who has Down syndrome, kind of, she is her subject matter for many, many of her projects. The one that is at IMOCA right now is a project called This Is Not About You, Number 2, which is kind of an interesting name, because a lot of people that came in were looking at it and they were saying, well, I couldn't do this. You know, I couldn't imagine, you know, filming my sister with Down syndrome, and
yeah.
then they read the title, and they say, "Oh, this is not about you." Okay.
I mean, is there a sense, like a fear, like, you know, is the sister being exploited, or?
Oh yeah.
Oh, that piece has caused the most controversy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't surprised. I sort of expected that when we started working on this exhibit, but I really, you know, I feel it's crucial to have this piece, and there's a good reason for it. Ted was talking about during the artist talk
mm-hmm.
how her sister Pim is the youngest of four girls. So there's like about a 7 to 10 year age difference between Pim and Ted.
Okay.
And she noticed that after Pim was born, how her family was treated in public was totally different. They had a whole different experience with the public and being out and about than before, you know, Pim was part of their life.
Sure.
And she just became really, you know, interested and, you know, somewhat upset about it. And then also you see, you know, when you go to Walmart or somewhere like that, you see these, you buy the pre-made photo frames and there's this family in there and they're all happy and they're blonde and,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's this perception and idea of what's beautiful and what's acceptable.
And, you know, why is it, you know, why is that? I think that's something, you know, and then, you know, even when I was working Thursday in the gallery, two little girls came in and they were probably 8 and 10 and they walk in that back room and they are like, oh my gosh, she's so ugly, you know, and their mom, you know, they had that conversation, you know, that was an experience for them. And I think that is something for people to consider and that they should consider.
Carl?
And adding to that, Ted, the way she describes it is having her sister in her work is a way for her to get to know her better, to try to understand her. And even though she's been, you know, documenting her sister's life along with hers so many years, she still, until this day, says, I still don't understand where, how she thinks, why she does the things that she does. There's one of the videos is of Pim writing, and it's just very repetitive symbols, you know, you can't really, there's nothing that you can actually read. It's just something that she does when she needs to get away from everyone, as Ted said. And, you know, Ted was trying to find a logical reasoning behind what she was doing, and it was just that. It was her way of...
And it isn't there.
It isn't, and for her, it's very hard. And the first day that she saw the video up, she sat down, and she got very emotional. She said, I still can't get used to looking at her, you know? And I was kind of shocked at that because, I mean, I can't imagine being so far away and then seeing your sister projected onto a giant white wall and, and feeling that. I mean, I'm sure it's overwhelming, so...
Yeah. I mean, she's made herself very vulnerable with this piece, and you know, I think that, you know, the reason is because how society has responded to her and her family.
Well, it definitely sounds like two very interesting, provocative pieces.
Yeah.
Certainly one celebrating different types of love and relationships and also expression. Again, at IMOCA through September 21st.
Travis DiNicolo with Chate Marsh from IMOCA and Carla Romero from Humanize Magazine. To get more information about IMOCA, visit indiemoca.org. That's indiemoca.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know what's happening this weekend?
Let's see. A lot is happening this weekend.
A lot is happening. There's so many choices. But one thing in particular is coming to an end, and you
State
can
Fair?
Stop wrecking your diet with fried food. but seriously, if you haven't been to the Indiana State Fair, it wraps up this weekend. You should go. Among other things, you should go to the Home and Family Arts Building and check out all the great arts and artisanal activities there, especially the photography shows. Go see the Master Gardener Demonstration Garden, which is up by the DNR building, and come with me and check out the 4-H State Fair Dog Show, which is going on this weekend. In particular, look for the Canine Drill Team, which includes kids from 9 to 18 years old working with dogs to develop routines that are choreographed to music. We've talked about cat choreography before.
Yes,
it only
have.
Seems fair to talk about dog choreography.
Sharon, you are obviously so excited about what's going on at the State Fair this weekend that you forgot to tell people that...
Oh.
This is that segment of the show we call
What Will We Do at the Indiana State Fair?
Yeah, other than going to the State Fair.
I'm so sorry.
Wow.
I was very excited about
that. I could tell. You just jumped right in there, didn't you?
I've been there 4 days already. I'm just really doing up the State Fair like never before this year.
Well...
Sorry.
No. That's fine. Well, in addition to the State Fair, the Fringe Fest starts this weekend.
It does.
And that's a big thing. And there's so much. I mean, so many shows. Grab yourself a schedule. Check it out online. And we'll be talking more next week about ones that we really enjoyed and ones we want to see and stuff. But I do want to give one shout out to Saving the World Through Bumper Stickers, which is the first show that Jim Poyser from Nouveau has ever done.
Yeah.
And it's all about planet Earth and saving it with bumper stickers. And he's going to be performing six shows over the next week and a half or so, and you can get that schedule for Jim's show as well as all the other ones at indiefringe.org. Remember to get your backer button.
Don't let him get those stuck in his nice long hair. That would be unwieldy.
There you go.
Sorry, Jim. Hey, would you like to design a new T-shirt for Public Radio? I know you would. Threadless has teamed up with NPR for the My Sound World T-shirt Design Contest, which challenges artists and listeners around the globe, because we're everywhere, to show how the sounds and stories of public radio inspire you. Your design could end up in the NPR shop. I don't think you're going to make a whole bunch of money from it, but, you know, there's pride in design. Create, submit, and vote through August 26th at threadless.com/NPR. Threadless.com/NPR in the next couple weeks.
Sounds pretty cool.
It does.
Great opportunity. Hey, the Irvington Branch Library and Book Mamas, the bookstore in Irvington, are joining forces to host a 150th birthday party. 150th for Hoosier environmentalist and writer Gene Stratton Porter on Saturday, August 17th at 1:30 p.m. in the library out on East Washington Street. And Barb Morrow, author of Nature's Storyteller, The Life of Gene Stratton Porter, will speak on her life and works. And the documentary, Gene Stratton Porter, Voice of the Limberlost, will also be screened. And there will be a birthday cake, even though Gene Stratton Porter will not be there. But Book Mamas will be offering Morrow's books for sale, and it should be a really great event going on Saturday at 1:30.
I heard they're not having 150 candles, though, because they don't want to put that much carbon in the atmosphere because it's very environmental. Hey, don't forget, also this weekend, if you're heading east, you might go even further east than Irvington to the Cumberland Arts Goes to Market festivities this weekend. In fact, this Saturday in Cumberland. Lots of food, lots of arts, lots of music.
One of my favorite bands is playing this weekend at Marsh Symphony on the Prairie.
Yeah.
Big Bad Voodoo Daddy.
I love
that.
Yeah,
they're playing a Friday and Saturday night, both nights at 8 p.m. as part of their 20th anniversary tour for Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. That should be a really good show to check out.
A band that's got a name that's just fun to say. Mm-hmm. Take your dancing shoes, too. Wear your dancing shoes. Hey, for a completely different kind of musical experience, this Friday, if you're hearing us Saturday morning, I hope you went to this. Il Troubadour Klingon Music Project invades the Indianapolis Arts Garden this Friday at 12:15, backed by popular demand in conjunction with Gen Con. Il Troubadour performs Klingon music.
What a hoot.
Their mission
That's
is
so
to
fun.
Record and perform all existing songs in the complete musical oeuvre of the Klingon Empire. That's
wow.
all I need to say about that.
That is pretty impressive. Hey, I know, start to think about Penrod, because, of course, Are the Matter will be out there. Sharon will be broadcasting live that day, and you can get tickets to Penrod now already. But one thing you might also consider is new this year, they're doing an evening with Penrod at the IMA the night before on Friday the 6th from 6 to 9. And there's going to be art and entertainment and food and drink, and Todd Snyder's going to be rocking the main stage. And there'll be a preview of all the artists and some stuff from Flat 12 Beer Works. And you can get more information at the IMA's website about that as well.
My last item, this Saturday night at 8 p.m. at Garfield Park, part of the Vintage Movie Nights, curated by and presented by Eric Grayson, Metropolis, a classic 1927 silent film accompanied by live piano. And it's a fascinating and dark, futuristic film. And if you've never seen it, especially on a big screen, you should go.
Cool.
GPACArts.org. GPACArts.org for more information.
And very quick last thing, if you missed the show, Love, Loss, and What I Wore at the Phoenix Theater, don't worry because it has been extended into September. It's going to be running through September 15th. They've added extra dates, so good for them.
Yay.
And we'll be back next week with that calendar. What do we call it, Sharon?
What'll we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Madelon O'Martin debuts his new one-man show, Trailer Park America, story of a progressive white trash liberal at the 2013 Indie Fringe Festival. Matt started out in the arts as a punk rock drummer, moved up to being a solo singer-songwriter, and is now working as a stand-up comedian. Guest interviewer Melissa Davis invited Matt to our studios to talk about his upcoming show.
Thanks for coming to the WFY studios today for the Art of the Matter. And we're going to talk about, you have a new show coming up,
yeah.
Trailer Park American for the Indie Fringe Festival.
Yes, yeah, it's my first time at the Fringe Festival, which I'm very excited to kind of go a little deeper with my stand-up and do some more storytelling. So I'm very excited to do it.
And yeah. Now you're a working stand-up comic.
Yeah, I'm going in about, it's about my second year of not having a day job, just doing comedy full-time, traveling all over the Midwest, primarily and occasionally more exotic places, doing stand-up. So yeah, I'm very lucky.
Your songs and Tremfu definitely had sort of a comic element to them.
Yes.
Have you, did this all kind of connect together, do you think?
I think so. I've always tried to put as much of my personality into everything that I do, whether it was in the crazy punk rock band or even in the singer-songwriter-y aspect, even though the songs were kind of a more dark, serious subject matter. In between songs, I was very funny with the banter. And that was one of the first inclinations I thought that I should try to do stand-up, is I had so many many people compliment me on my between songs banter. You know, I actually had a couple of times where I'd ask someone at the end of the show if they'd like to buy a CD, and they asked if I had a CD of my banter, which I said no, and then they said no thanks, and they left, and I was very sad. And I definitely, by no means do I think I'm a punk rock comic or anything like that. My comedy has really been a little bit more about getting in touch with my roots, where I grew up, which is rural Indiana, very poor, in a trailer park, which that's the name of the show. And so it's kind of a balance between that and then also having spent a good 20 years in rock and roll and in this sort of alternative underworld, and sort of the balance between the two. So I guess all the other pieces have led up to this, I guess.
Do you find that it is more difficult to be a working artist in Indiana, or is that just maybe the wrong assumption? Or
That's an excellent question. I've never tried it elsewhere. I mean, there are, you know, there's always this idea that if you're in a big city, you have the opportunity to work on your craft every single night. When I started off in comedy, when I was just open micing, you know, I'd drive to Indianapolis, I'd drive to Louisville, I'd drive to Chicago, just to get 5 minutes of stage time. You know, you spend several hours in the car each time, and this is, you know, on a weeknight, and then you have to go to work the next day. So there's those disadvantages of being in the Midwest. But I also think, and I thought this about playing music as well, I think there's something about growing up in a place where there's not a lot to do, that you kind of are forced to create your own entertainment and also your own kind of version of things. I think that if I were to have played music in New York or L.A., I'm not sure I would have come up with Tremfu or come up with my singer-songwriter persona and like the way that I did those songs. I might have been a little bit more emulating what was around there. I think there's, if you kind of grew up in a void, which is not as easy to do now because of the internet, you know, I'm going to be 40 next month. So, you know, most of my genesis of my personality and my artistic view, I had to make it up, or what I could glean from very small pieces of the outside world that made its way to Indiana. I think there's probably pluses and minuses to both sides of it. You're definitely in the car a lot more as an artist in the Midwest, that's for sure. So.
Well, in your new stand-up show, mm-hmm. How did you get to this point? Because it seems you've really built your stand-up act in maybe a short amount of time, I don't know, but you're successful.
Yeah, so, thank you.
Yeah, but how did you get to this point?
I started stand-up when I was 35, which is really late. Most people start when they're 18, 19, 20, somewhere in there. So there's a certain disadvantage there, but I saw it as a big advantage because I already had a divorce under my belt. I had already traveled around the world. I had a lot of things to talk about. The typical 18-year-old comic, when he starts off, doesn't really have much to talk about. He's making jokes about video games, 18-year-old boy stuff or whatever, you know. And so I was a little bit more relatable to the average comedy audience. And then also, there was definitely a sense, you know, I had done the music thing, and that had been fun, but had never really become a full-time financial situation for me. So when I started comedy, there was definitely a sense of, like, this is the second chance. If I'm going to do it, if I'm going to reinvent myself at 35, I got to go all in. And so I pursued it a lot more aggressively than I think most people, when they start, they kind of flirt with stand-up for a few years. And I, after that first open mic night, I basically just jumped all in. You know, I had some lucky breaks, which was fortuitous, but then I also worked my butt off. and so... Yeah, and I still have a lot more, you know, farther to go. This show, I think, is kind of the next step. It's going to be the first time I've done a full hour. Typically in a comedy club, I'll do anywhere. Typically, I'm doing about 30 minutes. Sometimes I'll do as much as 45 minutes. But this will be the first time I've done a full hour. And it's also me growing a little bit. And you know, it's culled from the autobiographical portions of my stand-up set where I talk about my upbringing and you know, my life and how I've kind of developed this worldview. But it's allowed me to kind of go a little bit deeper and push myself to write about things that I initially thought there was no jokes there. You know, if it was a relationship with my father or whatever, I just kind of skipped that. And, it's like I'm not telling the whole story now. But with this, it's forced me to kind of get into that a little bit more, which has been good because it's forced me to find the funny in it and kind of also face these kind of, sort of things that I've been skirting as an artist.
I'm assuming a lot is about your family.
Not much. The show basically is in three acts. Not really. It doesn't seem like it. It's going to just seem like one stand-up special, basically. And I really am pushing that all to be funny. There's a couple of serious moments, but then they end with a joke. But yeah, there's some stuff about my family in there, you know, covering the sort of the porn, growing up porn, the trailer and that kind of stuff. But you know, I don't really have a whole lot to complain about. You know, I mean, I was raised by a strong single mother that was amazing, and I never felt like I was lacking anything, you know. But father figure, he's in there, you know, he needs to be discussed, but there's not a whole lot of show. It's not a daddy issue show, I guess is what I'm trying to say, Melissa. It's a lot of fun. Everybody can come see it. It will not be directed by Wes Anderson. All right.
Nice.
Yeah, but it's kind of, the show's in thirds, and there's a third sort of about my my upbringing, a third sort of about my relationships, and then a third is kind of the world traveling side of it and stories and learning about other cultures and just kind of random craziness that you see when you travel for a living.
Yeah. What do your parents think about it? Are they impressed? Are they a little freaked out? Or
well, my mom, yeah. I mean, at this point, after, you know, punk band to singer-songwriter, you know, so my mom has been incredibly supportive the entire time, and I think she knew early on, you know, this was what I had to do to be happy. It was to kind of pursue these sorts of dreams. My father passed away a couple years ago.
Sorry.
And that's okay. And it was interesting because we had a chance to sort of reconnect. He wasn't really in my life, but right at the end, we got to reconnect for a couple of years, which was weird, but it's like one of those things that Dr. Phil says you should do. So, you know, I tried it. I imagine he would be very proud of me. I honestly think that a lot of my sort of fearlessness and BS skills, which come in handy in comedy, are kind of genetically driven from him. So, yeah.
Seeing it doesn't seem like you have a bad outlook on growing up in, you know, in a trailer park.
Absolutely not.
I think that that's a really unique perspective because you hear a lot of times about how terrible it is and all the issues there.
Yeah, I try to do this in my stand-up too. I've tried to find a way to talk about poverty-stricken, but like sort of the lower class citizens of this country, which I grew up in. I mean, you know, we grew up going to my school the first Saturday of every month and getting government cheese and having food stamps for the first several years that I was around. That was how we survived. I've tried to not denigrate those people, and I've also tried not to celebrate this sort of, there's a lot of celebrating white trash idiocy, whether it be Honey Boo Boo and shows like that where, or I'm a redneck and go to hell and blah, blah, blah. You know, this sort of justification of a closed-mindedness. And I am trying to put forth this idea that there's amazing life lessons to come from growing up rural and poor. And most of them have nothing to do with this false bravado or not wanting to kind of better your situation. And so I guess I'm an optimistic white trash guy. That's the subtitle of the show, is Story of a Progressive White Trash Liberal, which is how I see myself. There's a whole generation, I think, also of people that are growing up poor in trailers or in Section 8 housing or whatever that are a bit more enlightened thanks to the internet and also just thanks to the slow moving cultural tide. And so I'm trying to celebrate those people, that you can go to the county fair and watch Demolition Derby and think that's amazing and awesome, and you can love Bob Seger, but in the same hand, you can also be in an interracial marriage and have gay friends, and you know, and it all makes sense. To me, that's the new, you know, it's often called the New South because you see it more there, but I think it could be the new Midwest as well.
What do you think you've learned from growing up the way that you did?
I'm probably the least picky person you'll ever meet about eating food. You can suggest any restaurant on the planet, I'll be like, okay, let's go, or any meal. I think that you learn a humility. I think there's also a sense of humor that you develop when you grow up with next to nothing. There's a great tradition of Appalachian humor, which is sort of a very dark sort of death-obsessed kind of humor. It, you know, it's called gallows humor, really. And I think you get a version of that. Obviously, the Appalachians are the most extreme poverty that we have in this country. And, you know, and it wasn't that bad. You know, we had running water and things like that. But, I mean, you get a version of that when you grew up really poor. And then, of course, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't admit that my earliest comedy influence was, of course, Hee Haw, which we watched religiously. Oh, you know, my set at Fringe, there's a cornfield. I'll just be popping up and telling jokes and popping down. And
really?
No, of course not.
Like, wow.
I don't have the thighs to do that many pop-ups and pop-downs for an entire hour. Maybe the next show.
What should we expect at your show? What will we see?
It's very informal. It's going to be just like my stand-up. Again, it's just going to kind of go... It's a one-man play, I guess, or show. And it's very sparse. It's just me on stage. But there's not a lot of artifice. There's not a lot of I'm the performer, you're the audience. I'm treating it like a stand-up comedy show. Something organically happens and people want to interact, and we'll do that. But I'll just be telling my story, and it's all funny. That's the thing, is there's a lot of heavy stuff at Fringe, and it's great, you know, because when we need to see that stuff and we need to think about these issues that people are bringing up. But after two or three of those, maybe pop into my show and we'll have some laughs, and, you know, it'll be good. And we'll talk about some stuff too, you know, like race and class in this country. But I'm not preachy. It's all my personal experience, and this is what I've seen. So.
That was WFYI's Melissa Davis with Madelon O'Martin, talking about his indie fringe show, Trailer Park America, Story of a Progressive White Trash Liberal. The show will be presented at Comedy Sports starting on Friday, August 16th through Sunday, August 25th. You can get the whole schedule for Indie Fringe, of course, at indiefringe.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll find out why not all graffiti is bad at a preview of Midwest Graph.
I'll take a look at this year's Hoosier Salon exhibit.
And I'll find out how Clues Hall is celebrating its 50th anniversary, and we'll have our arts calendar of events we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.